Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
On Commons People this week, how do we improve safety for women?
I would dance with the devil to make women and children safer. This is the reason I got involved in politics.
Is Boris Johnson the right man for the job?
I'm not the type of person, I think it's pretty well known, to sort of sit back and accept, really quite disparaging and derogatory remarks.
And how will the first Red Wall by-election play out?
We've just got to go to Hartlepool and talk about the things that the people in Hartlepool care about.
Hello and welcome to Commons People. I'm Arj Singh and joining me this week is Paul Waugh.
Hi, Arj.
Hi, Paul. Rachel Wearmouth's here.
Hi, Arj.
Hi, Rachel. And we've got Labour's Shadow Domestic Violence Minister, Jess Phillips.
Hi, Arj.
Hi, Jess. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks. It's nice to be here.
Good. Well, it's been a highly significant week in the battle to improve women's safety after the killing of Sarah Everard propelled the issue up the political agenda. The week began with ugly scenes of the Metropolitan Police officers grabbing women, holding them down and leading them away by handcuffs for attending a vigil in Everard's memory during lockdown. Despite the troubling images, Met Police Commissioner Cressida Dick looks likely to hold on to a job, and government legislation to crack down on protest rights passed its first vote in the Commons. But there was better news later in the week as ministers bowed to pressure and announced that police forces in England and Wales would be asked from this autumn to record crimes caused by hostility based on sex or gender. Meanwhile, questions have been raised about Boris Johnson's suitability to lead a drive to improve women's safety. Let's hear Priti Patel being challenged by Robert Peston on some of the PM's past comments.
If one of your male colleagues said about you that the best way to manage you is just to pat you on the bottom and send you on your way, what would you say to that male colleague?
Well, I would not accept that at all. It's fair to say that I would say to my colleague, if that ever happened, that is just simply unacceptable. We've just spoken about treating each other with respect. That is simply not respectful. It's appalling.
So I probably ought to tell you that that is what the Prime Minister said when he left his job as editor of The Spectator about his female boss, Kimberly Quinn. So do you want to tell the Prime Minister now that he shouldn't have said that?
I wouldn't hesitate. And believe me.
Paul, how do you think the government's dealt with the aftermath of Sarah Everard's killing?
Well, I think the most interesting thing was in PMQs, the tone that was set by both leaders to start off with. Certainly sounded like both of them wanted to have a bit of unity at long last on this and put aside party politics and recognise the moment. I mean, obviously, there's got to be some kind of massive change in the wake of what the outpouring of the reaction that's happened in the wake of Sarah Everard's killing. But as Jess and everyone else will tell you, why should it take another tragic murder to force political change? But the fact is that there was a sort of new tone in PMQs. Now, you might say that was just might have been skin deep, but certainly was there. Both leaders saying they wanted to work together. You can't strip the politics out of this. Obviously, you can't ever, because, politics is all about doing things and different priorities and whether or not people have been doing the right thing over several years and have they now got the right strategy in place. So it is still political and there will be differences. But I thought that's what struck me was actually finally there was a consensus that the something should be done approach to this actually really might mean things are going to be done. The thing is that there's lots and lots of things that are already ongoing. But, you know, the pace of change has been so, you know, snail-like that I think that people are saying that the real legacy for Sarah Everard could be if somehow, even if one more murder of one more woman is prevented from all of this policy change, then that would be fantastic. But in terms of the detail, I mean, what struck me as well was this week, it seemed as though the government realised how enormous this moment was. You know, reopening that survey for women and girls, they've got 78,000 responses since they reopened it on Friday. That just underlines just how behind the curve politicians have been on the whole, I think, and particularly the government, that there's this massive outpouring. People wanted to have their say and they got more of it. A couple of changes, mini concessions this week in the Lords, which was interesting. You know, Jan Royal forcing the government to look again at a national stalking register, which is woefully overdue. And I was struck during that debate by three women who spoke. Jan Royal, who recounted the experience of several women and their families who suffered from the stalking nightmare. There was Sal Brinton, the Lib Dem, who had personal experience of a three-year campaign of stalking by her Tory opponent in a general election, and who eventually, despite that three-year campaign, he was just given an 11-month suspended sentence. Mm-hmm. And you had Gabby Burton, David Cameron's former press secretary, who was recalling again how her 18-year-old cousin was murdered by a stalker. And it was incredibly moving, three women in succession in the Lords talking very personally about what happened. And at the end of it, finally, there was some kind of incremental change, which is the government saying, yeah, well, we're going to look at this stalker's register. And then yesterday we had this, as you said, Arj, you know, that again, another concession about police, all police being required from the autumn to record crimes that have been motivated by hatred of women. So there's been little bits of change. I mean, the bigger picture is obviously still, you've got to say, the fact that you know, the prosecution rate for rape is still woefully tiny. And ultimately, we might have to come back to the sheer politics of the way things like the criminal justice system has been the Cinderella service. The Ministry of Justice has always been the department. Whenever we've done budgets, whenever we've done spending reviews, and you look at the figures, you see the cash going to health, the cash going to education. We always look, well, who's going to be the big loser? For the last 10 years, we've done the same calculation. It's always the same two departments, Ministry of Justice and councils. And they're the sort of stealth cuts that maybe finally people are waking up mm-hmm. to.
Jess, I believe you're keen on a cross-party approach, but do you think the PM's the right man to lead that job, or would you like to see maybe Priti Patel or someone else leading on?
I very much doubt that the Prime Minister will do anything more than, like, you know, hold a meeting. I don't, you know, and to be fair to him, I don't expect much more of him directly. I'm not, do you know what? I would absolutely love to sit here and completely and utterly excoriate the Prime Minister for every sexist or even racist thing that he's said in the past. But, you know, it doesn't get me anywhere. I think that Priti Patel, after Pest and Astra about it yesterday, you know, it's pretty shaming enough for that to sort of draw a line for it for me. The only way he can come back from that is with actual action, not just more words. I don't need more words. I need it to, and I can already feel it becoming less important as the week has gone on. I can already feel them being like, okay, right, we've given them a couple of things. I think we've probably got through this, heads down. Now we'll just put out the rate review and the strategy, and it'll just say things like, everybody's got to work better together. And I'm not going to tolerate it, because I've been on this treadmill for nearly two decades, and something has to change fundamentally. And they've got to see this for the fundamentals that it is, because what the Prime Minister went away and came back with, they had a little meeting, which I offered to go to, and in a cross-party affair. Nobody has been in touch with me from the Home Office or from the Prime Minister's office. And that was not the case under Theresa May. She would always, when I was like, I'll help, I would always get some form of a call. But nobody's been in touch with me at all. But I think that's probably because they don't know how to handle me, if the truth be told. They'll be like, oh, gosh, what are we going to, we'll end up giving her everything or nothing, and either way, she'll. So I think there's probably a bit of that about it. You know, I can't bear there just being more words about it. And when the Prime Minister got that little meeting together the other day, because they had to sort of quickly rush something out the door, I mean, it was the equivalent of monkey tennis, what came out of that meeting. I reckon they just had some words in two separate bowls. And they were just like, oh, somebody's like picked out the one that says CCTV, and somebody else has picked out the one that says undercover police officers and bars. And literally everybody who's ever worked in this area or has any expertise all went, what? I have such a deep, like, misunderstanding about what the undercover police officers in bars is meant to do. I've heard two different versions. So they came up with this idea that they're going to put more undercover police officers in bars who will then, if they see persistent, I don't know, pestering, it's none of this is against the law, of course. You can harass people in the public realm. There's no law against the street harassment. So if they see this, an identifiable crime that doesn't exist, they're going to intervene. No, they're not going to intervene because they're undercover and they would blow their cover. Sorry. It's confusing. They're going to go and find a uniformed police officer because, as everybody knows, in every city centre, thousands of them milling about. I mean, you can't swing a cap for hitting a uniformed police officer. It's literally 20,000 fewer than there used to be. But thankfully, there's still one on every, you know, every 5 yards. So then they're going to go and tell a uniformed police officer who will then go and intervene. For a start off, why can't a woman just go and tell a uniformed police officer and be listened to? I don't understand why I need somebody, you know, sort of like doing a little secret code into his shoulder to tell a police officer. The second thing is that then somebody said to me, oh, well, actually, it's not that. It's what they're going to do. It's been really poorly reported, which, fair enough, I could understand that might happen. Actually, what it's going to do is they're going to send in undercover units to areas, nighttime economy, bars and things that have really high rates where people have already high rates of assault and they think that there are prolific offenders there. And I just said, can I just ask why that hasn't happened already? And why do those places still have their licenses? So it takes the murder of a woman, which was one of many that week, it takes her murder for prolific offenders and hotspots to be targeted by police where violence against women and girls was known to be happening. I'm at a total loss, is all I can say with what they came up with. And that's why I would like to extend a hand of expertise.
Is that a way of getting at it, actually, Jess? It's an interesting point you raised there. Should premises maybe have their licences sort of under threat if there's a lot of crime happening at that bar or club?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, actually, the Equality Act already, I think, under the Equality Act, although, you know, most people aren't going to instigate this, if you report it to the proprietor, they have a responsibility to do something about it. It's why lots of bars have security. So they have a responsibility to clear it out. And if they don't, and they're like, oh, you know, I used to work in bars, and there was an attitude that was, oh, you know, he's a regular. It doesn't matter that he fills your ass when you're walking past, you know. He's a good customer. You get a lot of that. But what we, after the Me Too movement, lots of us campaigned. In fact, the Women in Equality Select Committee wrote a report, and we recommended to the government that they put in a duty on employers to prevent. And so that if they hadn't acted to prevent and somebody was abused who was one of their employees, they would be liable as an employee. Obviously, what do you think the government did? Nothing. They did nothing. They did nothing about the last moment that we had. No piece of legislation has changed to make women any safer at work from sexual harassment. So I really hope that this isn't the case this time. So we'll see.
Yeah, since we're on it, Rachel, the government has made moves this week, but what other measures have been called for and what could be effective? We've kind of talked about it a bit there.
Yeah, I think we covered earlier this week that the police are now going to start recording misogyny as a hate crime. And I think sort of moves toward that could be one of the most significant things that we see, because, you know, if you want to talk about perhaps how you would go about closing a premises down if the harassment would deemed to be aggravated by misogyny, if we got to that point where it became law, then that could potentially have a wider impact. But in terms of other things that have been suggested this week, Maria Miller has called for sort of an entirely separate bill, separate to domestic violence, separate to the policing Police and Crime Bill to deal with like sex harassment and violence against women and girls. The risk of sounding sort of ridiculously optimistic, one of the things that sort of struck me this week is that there is a sort of growing consensus about this being just about our culture more generally and about whether culture is misogynistic. I think in the past we've always kind of separated it out as, you know, domestic abuse was about, you know, something that happened in the home, and that was entirely separate to misogyny. And, you know, things that happen in schools are about, you know, how about education, you know, these are, they're all of these strands, I think, are sort of slowly coming together.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the reasons why Boris Johnson will continue to be under pressure for the things that he's said in the past. You know, children of single mothers are ill-raised, illegitimate, you should control your woman, or David Cameron's a girly swat, you know. And from a reporter's point of view, and Paul and Arjul attest to this, Boris Johnson's press secretary, Allegra Stratton, has been under a lot of pressure this week to kind of explain the Prime Minister's previous comments and to apologise for them. And I think that's just not going to go away for him, because he can very easily say in a very sort of polite atmosphere of the House of Commons, oh, you know, we have to do all of this, that and the other to support women. You know, and if we do continue to talk about how we need to change our culture, then the Prime Minister is going to have to acknowledge some of the mistakes that he's made.
He should just do that. He should just acknowledge it. Honestly, it would make it much, much better, because I'm not interested in the fact that Boris Johnson, do you know what? I can't rehabilitate Boris Johnson's sexism. I'm not even going to try. It's a massive waste of my time. He has a huge majority and the power to massively improve the lives of women in this country. So apologise for what you've done. And the best way to apologise, I say this to my children, sorry is just a word, sweetheart. Changing your behaviour and making a change is the thing that will prove to me that you're actually sorry. I don't want to hear the word. So he could tomorrow come out and say, we're going to have an end-to-end violence against women and girls bill. Now, incidentally, we'd asked for a violence against women and girls bill when the domestic abuse bill was first starting. We said, you cannot separate the issue of culture and harassment and rape. 49% of all rapes happen in a domestic violence setting. You cannot separate out the crimes against women and girls. But the government didn't want to do that. They wanted just to do a domestic abuse bill. And also they want to degender the crime. They want to be like, this isn't about women. This is about all people. And I'm afraid to say that's where they're going to miss the mark. That's where his sexism annoys me, because it stops action from happening where it needs to happen. He's got to understand this is a structural issue. If he just came out and said, I said these things and that was terrible and I'm going to learn, and how I'm going to do it is I'm going to deliver you a violence against women and girls bill that I'm going to work cross-party with the women from every single part of this House of Commons to tell us what is needed to be safe. Do you know what? He could have been saying all manner of hoo-ha in the past and I wouldn't care. That's what will make the difference. But so just say sorry and crack on with changing it.
You know, it's my view that he can't get away with not apologising forever, particularly when, you know, we're going
to
have...
Why would you bother to try?
Well, we're going to have these press conferences now where Allegra Stratton's going to be taking questions from journalists publicly. And this will not be the last time that we discuss it. And I think if he continues to just refuse to acknowledge it, I think that's going to... A lot of women who watch those press conferences are going to start to be as frustrated as the journalists who repeatedly ask this question.
Yeah.
Well, I think on the point of culture, it's interesting that, you know, the pandemic has sort of derailed schools a lot. But last year, for the first time ever, we do have compulsory sex and relationship education in schools now. That's the first time ever. And that brings us back to this point about politics matters, because Yvette Cooper was calling for that, you know, in 2011. And yeah. Michael Gove and Theresa May both dragged their feet on it. And it's only finally now, it's years later, it's finally actually happening in schools. And if you're looking at a long-term culture change, it's definitely the case, as with all forms of education, the only way you can break the chains of that go through the generations of people copying what their parents do is through the schools. And if you're at home and you see your dad treat your mum in a sexist way or even in a violent way, what's that shapes your whole worldview. And what's the answer to it? A is one way is obviously through youth groups and mm-hmm. other groups and different kind of mentors, but a key way is the role models in school and the education you get. Yeah. Now, one hour a week of education isn't going to make a massive difference, but at least it's a start in the conversation at an earlier age about equality and how to treat women. And maybe it would be a good idea if Boris Johnson sat in on a sex and relationship class himself.
Well, I used to do them. I used to hold consent classes and respect for women. I used to go into schools and do those classes. So I also, in offering to help the Prime Minister, I'm more than happy to run through some of the old materials with him if he wants me to. I'd be more than happy to. I think you're absolutely right. But although I think that it is that your education seems like it would be the silver bullet, and there's still, whilst we do have the legislation now, which was a cross-party piece of legislation, again Maria Miller, Sarah Champion, myself, Stella Rivett, and some people who are no longer in the House actually worked really hard to make that get through, but it still needs the government to step up with regard to resource and standards, because they left a loophole in that legislation that allows for head teachers to have latitude, much like the loophole that was left in the coronavirus regulations to allow police forces to have latitude. And unfortunately, all that does is it leaves police forces like the Met were and head teachers exposed. When, you know, as you saw in my constituency last year, you know, people want to protest about what that, you know, their kids being taught about sex and relationships. So it's, you know, I think the government has quite a long way to go before just resting on the laurels of the they've put that legislation through. And it can never always just be lip service, these things. You have to work on, you know, the detail. And the government loves saying stuff. They love legislation as well, like, you know, words written on goat skin rolled up in underneath the House of Commons is their absolutely favourite thing to do in the field of violence against women and girls. How it actually relates to real lives, less good. How welfare interacts, how housing interacts, how local councils, as you said, interact, how courts and police services and the cuts in those interact. There is a need for fundamental political bandwidth across the piece to make women more economically advanced in order to be freer from harm.
Isn't that Liz Truss's job as the women's minister in government? And, you know, to kind of bring that together across government. And she wasn't even at this task force meeting on Monday.
She's been such a massive disappointment to me, Liz Truss, because when she was the Justice Secretary, for that fleeting moment they allowed a woman into the job, she was absolutely pilloried by, and bear in mind, she was following in the very heady footsteps of Chris Grayling, literally the worst man to head up any department ever. And he had done a terrible job in justice. I mean, they've spent years having to undo what he did. And she suffered really terribly at the hands of sexism as when she was given that job. People were really sexist about the fact, I think that maybe she's not got a law degree, but neither did Chris Grayling, nor does he know anything about boats or ferries or anything in contracts even, it seems. But she suffered really, and I felt real sorority with her, and I used to go over to the Ministry of Justice when she was in that role and talk to her specifically around how we improve rape conviction with regard to women's previous sexual history being revealed in court. It's a massive issue where a woman's previous sexual history is used against her to basically call her a slut. And you can't be raped if you're a slut, of course, according to the justice system. And so I used to go over there. She was quite hardline about it, actually. And she was quite fierce, and she had a bit of steel in her about it because of this sexist treatment she'd received taking on this big role. However, since then, in her role as the Secretary of State for Women and Equalities, I cannot think of a single advancement that Liz Truss has overseen that in the pandemic has been devastating for women's economic advantage, employment and financial security. Devastating. And yet the majority of the work in the pandemic has been done by women. Where the hell is Liz Truss? Why in all of these recovery schemes in the budget is there nothing about care, childcare? Why is there nothing, Liz Truss, about targeted women's industrial strategy to get the women who've largely lost their jobs more than men back into work? Where are you, Liz Truss? Do you remember that we exist? Look in the mirror and remember that we exist and try and get out there and improve the productivity of the women of our country. Should be like, we want people at work. Well, me too, Liz. Try and help us get there.
And she hasn't been at a single one of those number 10 press conferences, has she?
No, she hasn't. I don't know what she's doing, buying soy sauce.
Jess, before we move on, you are now calling for cross-party working on this, but Labour's become embroiled in a bit of controversy this week after claiming in a political ad that rape has been effectively decriminalised by the Tories. Mm-hmm. Do you think that helped? And did you have sight of that ad before it went out?
No, is the answer. I didn't, but I don't. When you say, do you think it helped? The reality is, the Tories didn't like it. It wasn't said by, although I have said it many times, I've been saying it for about a year, so I'm stunned that they only got upset about it now. But it was said by Vera Baird, the Independent Victims Commissioner, appointed by the government. Not me. She is the one who lays that charge. And it's almost impossible to refute that charge, because every year, rape conviction has been dropping under this government. Every single year, it has been falling, as has domestic abuse. Prosecution been falling. So more people come forward and fewer people go to prison. So we have an increasing number of victims and fewer people ever being held accountable. So what am I meant to call that? 98.5% of all rapes go unpunished. Does that sound criminal to you? Imagine any other crime type with that statistic that is just... And I'm sorry that it upset them. They don't like it, do they? They absolutely don't like it. I mean, earlier in the week, I think it was Amanda Milling was saying that I was supporting child murderers because I wasn't going to vote for the bill, which is absolutely phenomenal. And luckily, anybody who knows me would certainly know that I've done considerably more work in this area than Amanda Milling. But nonetheless, they don't like it, but I hope they don't like it, because I don't like it either. I don't like that rape has been decriminalised. I'm really cross about it. And I hope that they're really, really, really cross about the performance of their government. I hope that they're shocked. I hope it's upset them. And I hope that they get pressure from their constituents about it, because them being upset isn't as bad as that. In this year alone, the amount of rape victims I've spoken to and had to say, I'm going to tell you, we're probably going to get nowhere with this, but let's keep trying. That's much worse, Amanda Milling. I'm sorry that I've offended you.
Well, crime is now likely to be a key issue going into the local elections in May, which now have some added spice after Mike Hill resigned as Labour MP for Hartlepool amid sexual harassment allegations. In something of a political Christmas for lobby hacks, though, it's triggered the first by-election of the Parliament in Peter Mandelson's former seat of Hartlepool. It's being seen as a key test of Keir Starmer's efforts to reconnect Labour with voters in the so-called Red Wall, and anything less than victory could lead to serious questions about his leadership. Let's hear Lisa Nandy's assessment of the battle ahead.
But, you know, I'm somebody who represents a constituency, lives in a constituency that is in the so-called Red Wall. And I genuinely believe that people in our communities are absolutely desperate for a country in which we support and reward those people who've got us through the last most difficult year. So when they look at issues like nurses' pay, they just cannot understand why the very people who are delivering the vaccine, who are keeping us safe, who are keeping us alive.
Paul, why is this by-election so important?
Well, it's the first by-election of this parliament, and also it's a kind of slight return to normal politics in a way, which is, you know, lots of us are delighted by, you know, good old-fashioned by-election campaign. There's good, you know, they're unpredictable in many ways, but predictable in other ways, because, you know, there may well be local campaigns that that take off. There might be very, very specific local issues. I'd be interested to see whether or not there's a proper independent that runs that could peel off votes from a Labour candidate. But I think overwhelmingly, given the result in 2019, when Labour was way behind and Jeremy Corbyn was loathed, and particularly in the North East, And when at a time when the party was, you know, nowhere near level pegging like it is now. I mean, it was 6 points behind, but it was way further behind then. Hartlepool still elected a Labour MP despite all of that. So even with the vaccine bounce, as it's called, I cannot see Labour losing this. I mean, you know, hold that quote against me. But, you know, but I honestly, if they do, there's something fundamentally very, very wrong. It might well be just a local quirk. But if you lose this election, I mean, Labour, there's some serious questions. That's why I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen. I think that there should be an increased majority, not a reduced majority. It depends on the candidate. If Paul Williams is the candidate, then I think that actually that could be really interesting because of his role in the NHS. Everyone, the Tories are going to pile against him all his second referendum support from the past. His simple answer to that will obviously be just like Keir Starmer's and everyone else's, which is, look, that's done with, that's settled, we're moved on now. And the most important pressing issue right now is coronavirus. Here's a guy who's actually, you know, on the front line helping out. And I think if they choose him, it'll be interesting. And I would expect them to increase their majority. But, you know, there's still that chunk of voters who in 2019 went to the Brexit party. You know, 25% of people in that election went to the Brexit party in that seat. And a large chunk of them, more than half of them, are Labour voters, former Labour voters. Mm. The big mistake is to assume that they're all Tory voters and somehow you can add that to the Tory total and the Tories are going to win. Even the Tories know that's nonsense. So it depends on how Labour approaches it and how on the front foot Keir Starmer is. If I was Keir Starmer, I'd actually, you know, take a risk and go up there a lot and be in that seat a lot and say, look, this is how we've changed. This is why we've changed. Not to shy away from it and not think, oh, God, this is really quite risky.
Paul, you've set yourself up for a Paddy Ashdown hat-eating moment with your bold prediction. But Jess, anyway, the Brexit party took a lot of the Labour vote in 2019. Are you worried about Richard Tice or a similar candidate start again, or Brexit and Paul Williams, if he's the candidate, his second referendum support being an issue?
I'm not worried about either of those things, actually, to be perfectly honest, because, I mean, maybe I'm just naturally not a very timid person, I suppose, is the best way to describe that. I think acting with timidity in this instance would be the wrong thing. And we've just got to go to Hartlepool and talk about the things that the people in Hartlepool care about. I'm not going to say what they are, because I think, you know, nobody from Hartlepool would be conned into thinking that I know anything other than apocryphal stories about Hartlepool. But I would gladly go up there and, like Paul says, confidently to campaign. You know what I found when you try negative politics that the Tories are already trying before a candidate's even been elected? It's really weird. And actually, I don't really understand their strategy, but then I don't understand a lot of what they do. I think that it's really, really dangerous when you try and go really negative, because one of the times I stood for election in the three times I've stood in 5 years in a general election, my opponent, who used to be the MP in the seat, went really, really negative, and my constituents really, really hated it. They got a bit like, all right, you know, don't need to be that mean about her. Like, she's one of us. Like, you're sort of slagging off one of your own, and they don't like it. And they also would prefer it if we talked about them, not about us and the things we care about in Westminster. If you were to knock the doors in Hartlepool or anywhere and say, what are your views on the People's Vote campaign, people? I bet most of them would be like, oh, I don't know, what's that, love? Do you know what I mean? Like, we've got to be really careful about how we obsess about things in Westminster that, you know, they just not necessarily have that terminology. So all of this attack I've been seeing this week has been odd. But now I very much hope we'll hold Hartlepool, and I'll be going up with the intention of making that happen with confidence, talking about the people in Hartlepool and about the future.
Yeah, Rachel, we've talked about Paul Williams there. What's he all about? And is he sort of nailed on to be the Labour candidate? Who are some of the other runners and riders, and what could the battle be like in that seat?
I think it cannot be overstated at all just how independent-minded Hartlepool is. I think we'll hear sort of loads and loads and loads of commentators talk about the Red Wall, but Hartlepool is, and I used to cover it as a local reporter, is like it's very much a law unto itself. You know, it had for a lot of years a directly elected mayor, and way back in 2002, it was taken by somebody called Stuart Drummond, who was an independent. He was elected three times, and he was his job before taking the mayoralty was he was the football club's mascot, Hangus the Monkey. And I think that kind of just, and if you look at local government in Hartlepool over a lot of years, there's a big trend towards independence. And I think Lib would do well to sort of, as what everyone here has talked about getting really stuck in and being scrappy about it. Because I think sort of Teesiders generally really appreciate that. Mm. When you look at sort of what happened at the last election, the Brexit Party took almost as many votes as the Conservative Party, and Labour just say squeaked it. So I think it'll be really, really tough. And in terms of Paul Williams, he's a doctor, which during the coronavirus crisis might be a big plus for the Labour Party. Mm. He's been doing shifts at the COVID clinic at Hartlepool Hospital. And we've mentioned again the Boris Johnson's vaccine bounce that he's that's been talked a lot as a big plus for the Conservatives at the local elections. But up there, sort of barely anyone under the age of 50 has had the vaccine yet at all. So I don't know how much a candidate like Paul Williams would work given the vaccine delays we're now about to expect. But going very hard on the government's handling of COVID-19 is also a big risk for Labour, because sort of a lot of research would show that support for the governing party goes up during big crises like this. In terms of sort of the other people that I've heard talked about as the Labour candidate, Laura Pidcock has been mentioned. She obviously lost Northwest Durham at the last election, but she's very, very, you know, she would be a very, very, like I say, scrappy candidate. The other person that's been mentioned is Tom Blenkinsop, who's the former
Middlesbrough. He's the definition of scrappy.
He's the definition of scrappy, yeah.
I say that in total love of Tom Blenkinsop, but he is the definition of scrappy.
In terms of who would be the Conservative candidates, very little's been said about that yet. I know in terms of the sort of, not the Brexit Party, but the Reform Party now, as they are. Richard Tice is considering whether he would stand again. At the last election, the Conservatives had a very local candidate, a Stockton council guy called Stephen Horton. But I don't know whether the Conservatives might actually want somebody with a bigger national profile, or if they would want to again pick out somebody local. I think one other thing I would say. Is that it's hard to also overstate how popular the Conservatives' mayoral regional mayor candidate for the Tees Valley area, Ben Houghton, is. And they've had a lot of very positive news about jobs for Teesside over the last few months, which is also something people should factor in when talking about the seat, I think.
Yeah, the government's pumping loads of money into Teesside. Do you think that's going to have a factor?
Oh, massively, play. Yeah. Sorry.
Do you honestly think that?
I think somebody
whose region has money pumped into it as well, mainly because if you've got a Tory mayor, they want to keep it that way just before an election. So there's a lot of pork barrels that go around. But I don't think that people feel it yet, any of that money. Like, we've got the Treasury moving to Wolverhampton. Honestly, I can't wait. Average people on the streets in my constituency don't think like Whitehall's really investing in us. Like, that's just like, it's not a thing that people actually think. They think, God, I can't get a copper to come. Like, you know, when something wrong, I wonder sometimes about all these big infrastructure things, unless they've actually created the jobs that people are in yet. And most people are, lots of people are still on furlough. And I just don't know if that it's, quick enough, the time for the by-election isn't enough.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. But with that, I think it's time for the quiz.
I'm not going to know anything, I'll tell you that now.
And amid Tory backbench uproar at the Integrated Review suggesting the UK could deepen its trade links with China, this week's edition is all on foreign policy.
Oh, God.
So just shout the answer if you know it.
David, could it not have been on Hartlepool?
Yeah, I mean, that would have been better.
And there's only one question to ask about Hartlepool, and it's about the monkey, isn't it? But anyway, let's carry on. Question number one. David Cameron was sharply criticised in 2010 after describing the UK as the junior partner in what?
China-UK relations.
Rachel, what were you saying?
I thought it was the special relationship, was it?
Yes, yeah. That's the right answer. Yes. He also said that the UK was the junior partner in the Second World War. When the US got involved. Yeah, which didn't go down very
Imagine
well.
Imagine if a Labour person said that now. Yeah. It would literally, the Tories would wear masks on their face with it written on. We'd have to be reminded of it every 15 seconds. There'd be a statue built with somebody holding it.
Question number two. In which state or nation were children named Tony Blair or Tony in honour of the British PM?
Kosovo.
Yes, well done, Paul. Blair got the UK involved in the 1999 NATO air campaign, actually played a key role against Yugoslavia in the Kosovan War and is seen by Kosovan Albanians as a hero.
Yeah, I know. I've met some Tony Blairs.
And it's spelled T-O-N-I-B-L-E-R.
Yeah, Tony Blair. I've met
Tony
some.
Blair. Yeah, nice.
I've met some Rwandans as well who were fairly keen.
Right. Fairly keen. Nice. Final question. It's between Paul and Rachel for the win. Boris Johnson is famous for his foreign affairs, among other gaffes, but he was given a rap on the knuckles from Theresa May for comparing which foreign leader to a Nazi dishing out punishment beatings.
Oh, was that Francois Hollande?
Well done, Paul. Yes.
My God.
You've won the quiz.
Francois Hollande, he doesn't seem like he's could feature enough to described.
He's a lover, not a fighter, that's for sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like he seems a mild-mannered sort, Francois Hollande. Didn't he go out with Ségolène Royal as well? She was the one who never made it.
And then he went out with that young actress, what's she called? Juliette Gayet or whatever. But anyway.
Francois Hollande.
They were on a scooter together, weren't they? Famous photo.
But,
He was caught having an affair, wasn't he? And then came here for a press conference with the PM and Chris Hope from The Telegraph asked him, do you wish your mistress was here? Which was slightly odd.
I mean, that's just... What did he say?
I think it was a Gallic shrug.
Oh, perfect.
Well, with the Gallic shrug, unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to my guests for joining me, and make sure you subscribe to Commons People on all the usual channels, and please be sure to leave a review. And get your daily dose of what's happening in Westminster by subscribing to the Warzone newsletter at bit.ly/the-war-zone. We'll just leave you with Jacob Rees-Mogg offering some strange moral support to the Queen during this difficult moment for the royal family.
All I will say is God save our gracious Queen, long live our noble Queen, God save the Queen, send her victorious, happy and glorious, long to reign over us, God save the Queen. O Lord our God, arise, scatter her enemies and let them fall, frustrate their knavish tricks, confound their politics, on thee our hopes we fix, God save us all.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.